And welcome everyone to another episode of All Things Trek, unfortunately not live on Trek Radio. I'm Oren.
I'm Grace, and
And
we have no David.
no, not this week, although he might be able to join back. We'll see. Basically, the long story short is that Comcast is having some serious issues in his area, and since he's the one who broadcasts us through Trek Radio, we would have sounded all funky and it just wouldn't have been good. So we're going to go ahead and just record this today, this week, and we'll put it up on the podcast feed, which is probably how you'll be listening to it.
He says Comcast problem. I still hear Borg invasion.
Don't be silly, Grace. Borg don't invade anything except Earth. It's always Earth. They're never interested in invading Romulus or Kronos. It's just got to go for Earth, man, because that's the special place. All right. So that aside, Grace, have you been following the whole Into Darkness brouhaha that's been going on the last few days?
Which one? What?
Like all of them. It's all sort of one thing. So you want me to give you the you me give you the lowdown? Okay. So it seems to have all started at Vegas when one of the various like best of panels was Best Star Trek Movie, which I didn't go to because I knew it was going to be Wrath of Khan. And it's honestly not that hard to rank the Star Trek movies. Like if you get a
No.
bunch of, you get a bunch of fans in a room, and generally it'll end up with something like Wrath of Khan, and then under that either Star Trek VI or First Contact, and then like, Star Trek IV, and you can pretty you reliably rank them.
Or just look at the Rotten Tomatoes ranking.
Yeah. So it's not hard to figure out for the most part. So I didn't go. But this turned into a thing. Because when they released the rankings, it wasn't just best movie, it was like a ranking from top to bottom. And they put Into Darkness at the bottom. Which, I mean, like, objectively, I can just say pretty clearly isn't correct.
No, that's not a fair assessment. It wasn't great, but it wasn't awful. It was no Search for Spock.
Yeah, I mean, or certainly not as bad as, say, Nemesis or Star Trek: The Search for God. So, I mean, I'm pretty sure that even though movies are obviously very subjective, I think that it's pretty clear that this vote is not accurate.
No.
Now, by the same token, like, whatever. These are people who have their own opinions about movies, and
Yeah, but their opinions are wrong.
All movies are going to have their detractors, so it's not really that big a deal. This wasn't a lot of people, is the important thing to remember, because you weren't at Vegas, but the this was all
Thank you
taking.
for reminding me, Oren.
Yeah, I know. This was all taking place in like the secondary theater room, and I like glanced in there before the whole thing started, and it was a fairly small number of people. Most of the people were in the main theater or in the vendors room or something. So you know.
Doing things that mattered.
So, we're talking maybe 50 to maybe 100 people at the most. I'm guessing closer to 50. So normally this wouldn't have been a problem, except the way everyone is reporting on it, and by everyone I mean I include like actual newspapers,
What?
like The Guardian. The Guardian read like actually ran an article with the title "Trekkies Denounce New Movie." Right, and people are talking about this like this was all of Las Vegas crying out in one voice that we hated the new movie, and like
I don't
that's
think the Guardian fully understands how conventions work.
no, I mean it's
Oh, God.
I've been comparing this to what would happen if you got like 50 baseball fans in a room, a bunch of them who happen to be Red Sox followers. And asked them what the worst team was, and then the next day you ran a story saying baseball fans denounce Yankees.
My God.
So it's bad reporting, is what it is. It's terrible reporting, but it's caught on, and it got to the point where people have been going back and forth to the point where Simon Pegg got like legitimately upset and like his feelings were hurt.
Don't do that to Simon Pegg.
And he like got really like belligerent in his Twitter, and depending on how you read his Twitter post, basically told Star Trek fans to fuck off.
Oh, great. Look what you've done now, nerds.
And it was sort of like, it's hard, you know, it was a little bit like, that seems a little uncalled for, Mr. Pegg. I mean, you know, like, you're supposed to be the professional here. I don't, but all right, so that happened. And
this
it gets,
is why we can't have nice things.
And see, it gets a little worse because now what we have is reactionaries who are acting like the people who had the, who participated in this vote were like this cabal of antisocial basement dwellers who made it their mission in life that no new Star Trek would ever be made.
Oh, Lord.
And it's just like, you know, these people don't deserve that abuse. Like, they were just in a highly informal setting where they voted via applause, because I went to some of the other panels run by TrekMovie.com, and it was very informal. It was not precise at all.
Oh, good grief.
So it was just like a fun thing they were doing at a con, and now they're either being held up as, like, the voice of the Star Trek fan base, or...
There is no spokesperson for the Star Trek fan base. Can we just put that on record there?
Exactly. And so people are treating this as, like, a huge thing, and it's gotten, like, and then it, like, went a step further, because it's not done yet.
Oh, good Lord.
It went a step further where, apparently, this is according to TrekMovie.com, they have...
Apparently what?
Hmm? Say what? Say what, Grace?
Apparently what?
Oh, I'm getting to that. Robert Orsi, one of the two writers...
Oh, Lord.
...went into the comments thread on this article that was talking about what the author thought was wrong with Star Trek, and started being really rude and belligerent.
Oh, good Lord,
and
no.
Now, granted, this is the internet, so maybe it wasn't him, but, like, TrekMovie.com has said it was actually him, and they have, like, actually had, you know, they've worked with him in the past. And so, basically, like, this whole thing is just making everybody look bad.
Yeah. Like, there's no good that can come from this.
Because, like, you know, Orsi is coming off as being really, again, assuming this was Orsi and not someone using his name. And this happened several days ago. He's coming off as being very unprofessional and being kind of a bully, you know, because, you know, he's the one in the position of power. And he's, you know, going and telling all these people that they don't have a right to their opinion because he's the best and they can all suck it. And, you know, saying things like, this is why I get to write movies and you don't. And it's just like, you know, that's just not cool. I mean, not everyone's going to like your stuff. I feel like a professional Hollywood writer should have a thicker skin than that.
Yeah, you'd think that, but I don't know. People get really weirdly worked up over fans, I guess.
They do. And it's kind of, I mean, like, most novel authors will tell you that you don't go online and argue with people giving you bad reviews.
Yeah.
Because there's no way you come out looking good in that. And the thing about this is, it's not like the people in this article were trashing the movie. Like, they weren't, they weren't, you know, swearing at Orsi and saying that he was the worst person ever. They were just calmly expressing their dislike of certain aspects of the film. And then Orsi comes on acting all belligerent. And it's just like, what is... And it's just... It's upsetting me because it makes me... wonder if the takeaway that Hollywood people are going to get from this is that it doesn't matter what you do, Star Trek fans will never like your movie.
Oh, Lord.
Or like your TV series or what have you. And it's just kind of like, it's a classic case of people blowing everything way out of proportion.
Yeah.
And making a bunch of stuff that didn't matter at all suddenly super important.
Oh, good grief.
Which is funny, because I was just reading a Discworld novel where that happens.
Yeah.
And then, like, I don't know, it just gets weird. Have you been seeing recently how every time, like, there comes some kind of pop culture discussion pops up, you get a bunch of commenters saying, why are you guys upset about this, and you're not mad about what's going on in Syria? Have you seen
that? Yeah, that seems to be kind of the guilt du jour, isn't it?
And it's
kind
of like,
it is something that we should be thinking about. We also are allowed to think about pop culture and concentrate on other things, you know?
Yeah, it's like, how do you know I'm not also upset about Syria?
Yeah.
And then by the same token, what would me posting angrily about Syria actually accomplish? You know, like, that's a very complicated situation they got over there.
Yeah.
It's, you know, like, as a person living safely over in the United States, I don't think I'm actually really qualified to render an opinion on Syria.
Yeah.
Like, I've never been there, I can only read the news that's available, most of which is very spotty.
Yeah.
So I don't know. It's all right. It's weird. That's my pre-topic rant out of the way.
All right. So moving on to our topic then.
Yes, because we don't have any emails this week because I either have been too nice or too angry. One of the two.
Quick, say something controversial.
Say something controversial. Okay, something controversial. Benedict Cumberbatch shouldn't have been cast as Khan. Okay, there we go.
I'm not sure how to react to that, Oren.
Well, you could assume that what I meant was that Benedict Cumberbatch was a terrible actor. That isn't what I meant, but, you know, you could assume I meant that. And then maybe send me an angry email about it.
All right, let's get some angry emails then.
All right, angry emails. But, all right, so our...
Anyway, David's not here, so I have to disagree with you.
I disagree.
Yeah. Yeah. Yes, I do.
I mean, I'm a huge fan of Benedict Cumberbatch. Like, I love Sherlock and a lot of the other stuff he's been in. I just don't think that he was good casting for Khan, is all.
I thought he played the character really well.
Yeah, he played the character as well.
The best character, so.
He did a good job with the role he was given.
Yeah, exactly.
So this is no slight on him. Yeah. It's just, it's a case of, like, A, it's questionable when you take a role that was written for a not-white guy and give it to a white guy.
Yeah, a very, very, very white guy.
Yeah. And it's not like Benedict Cumberbatch is some undiscovered, young talent who needed to boost up, right? So it's just that it's dislikable for that reason. It's also, I just kind of wish he hadn't been Khan. I wish he'd just been John Harrison. But
yeah. But, moving along, though.
Yes. So today we are talking about the 1956 film Forbidden Planet. And I can hear the listeners already saying, that's not Star Trek, what are you doing? and my answer is...
We'll soon be changing our podcast title to All Things Not Trek.
All Things Not... Oh gosh, that's a very broad...
What about Everything But Star Trek?
Everything But Star Trek. Alright, so next week, we're going to be talking about vacuum cleaners. And the week after that, it'll be, car tires. Those things are not Star Trek.
We're actually just going to turn into a Car Talk tribute show. It'll be awesome.
I don't think anyone wants to hear me give my opinion on cars. It's like, does it go? Does it use up a lot of gas? There we go, I'm done.
Don't drive like my brother. We're done. Bam.
Done and done. But, all right, so, but the film, Forbidden Planet, is highly influential in various, sci-fi shows and movies that we've seen, since then and into today. J. Michael Straczynski, who is a very, big sci-fi author, has talked about how it's his favorite film and how it heavily influenced him.
Yeah. Which you can really see reflected in his work.
Yeah, definitely. Mm-hmm. And there are also a number of things from the movie that influenced Star Trek.
I said, oh, yes.
Or that Star Trek kind of had to shy away from, kind of deliberately.
Yeah.
So, in case you haven't seen the movie, because I know a lot of people haven't, I haven't actually seen it.
What?
I mean, I watched it for the podcast.
Okay, good.
But I hadn't seen it before then.
Yeah.
And the only reason I even knew about it was because it has that very iconic image of the robot lifting up the woman.
Yeah.
Which never actually happens in the movie.
No, and the woman in the poster doesn't even really look like Dan Francis.
Yeah, she's blonde.
Yeah, someone just watched the movie and was like, great, we need a poster with the robot and a damsel in distress. And they're like, okay, we haven't seen this movie, but we're going to mock it up. Let's go.
Let's do it.
Yeah.
It also could have just been... Perfect. It also could have just been that this was one of those posters they made before the movie was actually out or finished.
Yeah, it's possible.
That's the thing that happens sometimes. It always amuses me when people who write novelizations of movies have to write the novelization before the movie is done.
Yeah.
So, they end up with these things that were supposed to be in the movie but got changed at the last minute.
That's especially funny in the novelization of the first Back to the Future movie, because originally the film was shot with another actor who had, a completely different look. So all the times in the book when they're describing Marty McFly, they're describing a completely different guy who looks nothing like Michael J. Fox.
Oh, dear.
Yeah, it's pretty funny.
Originally, or the alien novelization, had to write the book without knowing what the alien looked like.
Oh my god.
Because Ridley Scott was being so secretive about what the alien looked like that he hardly told anybody. He certainly wasn't going to tell the guy novelizing the movie.
Priorities, man.
Yeah, so there was a whole bunch of that, you know. There's a whole bunch of funny things about that. But, so this movie, supposedly, according to Wikipedia, which linked to a bunch of books I don't have, so I can't look up these primary sources, but supposedly, it's the first sci-fi film that was set entirely on another planet, or in space. There are no shots of it on Earth. And it's also supposedly the only sci-fi film with humans having their own starship. Like, one that they didn't take from Aliens.
Yeah, but it did look pretty alien-y. I mean, their spaceship, for those of you who haven't seen it, is pretty much the stereotypical flying saucer that you saw in 50s and 60s sci-fi.
Yeah, and it's, I mean, that was just sort of classically, I think, what a lot of us assumed spaceships would look like at that point. You know, like, for, I'm not sure where the flying saucer design actually came from originally.
Which is funny, because I think we see a shot of the crashed ship that they've gone into space to explore, and it looks more, you know, space rocket-like, but they're just going around in their little flying saucer.
Huh, I wasn't sure if we ever got a shot of the Bellerophon.
I think.
We might have, I'm not sure. All right, so, give you a plot summary, for those of you who haven't seen the movie. Spoilers, yo. So you have the United Planet Cruiser C-57D sent to Altair 4, because like in Star Trek, they're terrible at naming things in this universe.
Because
it's just Altair 4, the planet doesn't have a name, even though they sent people to colonize it.
Yeah, the terrible naming even, it continues. It's a theme in this movie, really.
And the ship doesn't have a name, it just has, like, a number.
Yeah.
And so they're here to investigate the 20-year-old disappearance of the Bellerophon colony ship, which, by the way...
never mind. Bellerophon, Bellerophon.
I thought it was Bellerophon.
Oh, yeah, probably.
All right. And by the way, the Bellerophon gets a name. Why does the United Planet Cruiser C-57D have to make do with that awkward number?
The Bellerophon was a privately owned and operated ship, I guess.
I guess. In the future, the Navy doesn't name its ships. That sounds like terrible luck.
Yeah.
Also bad for morale. It's like, you know, imagine like your captain being like, you have to give it all you've got for the C-57D. You know, it doesn't really say, it doesn't have the same ring as like, say, for the Enterprise.
Or the Excelsior.
Excelsior! And, you know, again, we see another Star Trek theme here, because this is something that happened 20 years ago, and they're only just now getting around to investigate it.
Starfleet is also very slow at getting shit done.
Yeah, it got, you know. So they show up to the planet, and they get this mysterious warning from a Dr. Morbius, who was kind of like Morbid and Mobius put together.
It's a Morbid Mobius, really.
And he's like, you guys shouldn't come here. And, of course, they follow his advice, and the movie is over.
if only.
Just kidding. They decide to go down...
That's another thing that Star Trek really took away from that, just not heeding warnings.
Although, in fairness, that guy was being really shifty.
Yeah.
Like, I wouldn't have heeded that warning either. It's not, you know, Star Trek took it to new heights when they would be like, we will make contact with this alien race by any means necessary.
Whether they like it or not.
Yeah.
We will be friends by force!
So they land on this planet, Altair 4, mind you, and it's, you know, it's all deserty and, you know, looks kind of like a soundstage with some cool matte paintings. And they got their flying saucer landing sequence, which it was interesting because as I was watching it, I thought, this must be what the studios thought was going to happen every week in Star Trek. And so Roddenberry was like, no way, man. We got this thing called a transporter. We don't have to pay to land the ship every episode. So that's it. So that was an interesting take.
That's how you budget creatively, folks.
Exactly.
Yeah. Transporter beams.
And so they're all like, you know, going down off the ship and looking around, and it's, you know, they brought a lot of extras, and, you know, they're all, you know, they all have guns, and they're all like, yeah, we're ready to, you know, deal with this planet, what have you.
Yeah.
And then, of course, you get a crazy car that flies up, and we get to meet Robbie the Robot!
Robbie the Robot, who, in my opinion, is the real star of the show.
He's the best character. I love Robbie the Robot.
Pretty much. And, It wasn't the idea that the character of Robbie the robot was supposed to be the first sci-fi robot with a personality of his own.
The first one in film, anyway.
Yeah, which is funny because we don't actually get to see him do much more than react.
But he does get to react kind of sarcastically.
Yeah, that's why we love him.
He is a keen observer of the human, you know, the human condition, as it were.
How it sucks.
Yeah, basically.
And really, he's the one that adds the esoteric backbone to the whole story in that way.
He does. I also like to think that car that he's hooked into the front of is like a Flintstones car. It's like powered. It's powered by him running across the ground.
So it's really more like a rickshaw, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly.
Rob the rickshaw.
So they decide to send some people to go talk to go, you know, to go with this robot to go talk to Dr. Morbius, and they send Commander John A. Adams or John J. Adams, excuse me, John J. Adams.
J.J. Abrams.
Yeah, I know. How did he get in this movie?
Damn, he's everywhere.
The first officer, Jack Kelly, and the ship's doctor, Dr. McCoy. I mean, hang on, his actual name is in here somewhere. Doc Ostro. He doesn't have a first name, apparently.
His first name is Doc.
So, you know, right away, even though they brought the whole ship down, you have immediately send the three highest-ranking officers, mm-hmm. To go on this mission. So, welcome to Star Trek. It's just 10 years earlier.
And who do they meet when they go to see Dr. Morbius?
Well, first, they meet Dr. Morbius and his amazing house. With his robot, who he then creepily informs them that it can't actually hurt them. And the way he does this is by ordering it to shoot them with a laser beam. And then it won't.
It does inspire a lot of confidence, really.
Yeah, it's like, Morbius, are you trying to be creepy, or are you just like that? But naturally, the highlight of all this is, of course, meeting the one lady in the show. Whose name is Altaria, because, again, they're terrible at naming things.
Yep, they named her after the planet.
Actually, they named her after the sun.
Shut up, Oren.
Because it's like Altaria 4, because it's the fourth planet in the Altaria system. Which is, from now on, I think we should start calling Earth Sol 3. See how we like it?
Personally, I think we should, give the movie a little credibility in the sense that, yeah, maybe they're really bad at coming up with names, or maybe they're trying to make a biblical reference with Eve being named for the Garden of Eden. In her, space paradise where she doesn't wear shoes, apparently.
That's probably true. And, I mean, Dr. Morbius is seriously in love with this planet, so it kind of makes sense that he would name his daughter after it.
Yeah.
And so you get...
You've got a planet heart on there.
Yeah, just a little bit. You get some creepy 1950s flirting, which is sort of comical, where it's, like, Kelly, the first officer, who is not Spock-like at all, I'm glad to say.
Yeah. He's anti-Spock, really.
Yeah, his name is Farman. I was looking at the actor's name, Jerry Farman. He goes and is, like, trying to flirt up with this lady, and they're all...
Taking advantage of the fact that she knows nothing about, sexual culture or anything.
That gets worse later, but at this point, all he's doing is try to flirt, and then he, like, kind of implies that the captain is a serial rapist.
Yeah, or that he's just a creeper.
And you get that funny, like... exchange where she looks and he's like and she's like, oh yes, I see it now, the way he looked at me, fire in his eyes.
Yeah,
it's like, I'm glad you don't have any fire. He's like, well, I've got a little fire.
That was actually pretty funny.
Yeah, I mean, it's,
well, hi,
this is going to be a common theme throughout the rest of the movie, is that a lot of really creepy flirting and romances with Alta. And the only reason it's bearable for me is that she reacts to this kind of the same way I am, which is, really? What's going on here? So everyone around her is acting terrible, but at least, she's acting fairly interesting.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, at this point, Morbius explains the actual plot, which is that everyone else on the Bellerathon got murdered by something. He doesn't know what. Like some, he describes it as a planetary force, right?
Mm-hmm.
And it's sort of like... Yeah. What does that mean? I don't know. But apparently he and his daughter are immune to it.
Mm-hmm.
And at this point...
Because they're special.
Say what, Grace?
Because they're special.
Yeah, well, they are special. And then, you know, you get to see he's like, there's all these like deer and tigers running around, and you know, Alter is friends with all of them because she's like queen of the forest, I guess.
Yeah, she's a pretty much a Disney princess, you know, with bigger boobs and less clothing.
Yeah, and that you know, that tiger thing will come back into play later because she's friends with this tiger, even though they're not in the same shot, which is kind of a funny
It's
special
implied
effect.
that they're friends.
Yeah. So then we get some like the you know the commander being all upset with Morbius, where he's like, "You need to tell us what's really going on." And Morbius is like, "I don't know, man. What do you want from me?" And so they're like, "I'm gonna have to contact Earth and find out what's going on." And Morbius is all upset about that idea. And then cue to invisible saboteur
Dun dun dun!
sneaks onto the ship somehow, and like, which is kind of funny because the guards are very nonchalant about the idea of a something, because like they hear something breathing as it sneaks past them, and they're very like, "Oh, it's probably nothing," even though I think they've already been like told at that point that there's some kind of force on this planet that kills people. And so
They aren't paying them that much to care.
probably not.
No.
And so, you know, their big communicator thing gets sabotaged, and we get like a
Sabotaged.
sabotaged, and we get a real Scotty moment when their chief engineer is holding it the next day, and he's like, "This can't be done, but I'm pretty sure I can do it."
It's impossible, except when it isn't.
Except, you know, I'm gonna do it now anyway. You know, I was surprised they didn't have the "How long will it take? An hour. You've got 5 minutes" scene. They didn't do that. So then they like go back to Morbius, and Morbius shows them the wonders of the secret aliens, which I
And what are these aliens called creatively?
they were called the Krell.
The Krell.
Which I mean, I don't know, that's all right. That's all right as far as names go. I can go with the Krell. Nuh-uh. All right. So he shows us all of these really impressive sets with the Krell, right? And the Krell are, you know, built these huge underground tunnels and, you know, have all of this like superpower, and they have energy like meters that are measured in Pac-Men, or that's what those look like. And he describes it as having the power of like 92,000 thermonuclear reactors, which is a fair number of thermonuclear reactors.
Yeah, that's a butt ton of thermonuclear reactors right there.
A lot of thermonuclear reactors. And like, they sort of imply that the Krell were triangle shaped.
All their doorways are super pyramid-y.
Sort of. Like the first couple few are, but then they go back to being rectangular. Also, did you notice in that sequence where they have like the walkthrough of this big like platform over that's overlooking like a giant chasm that you could fall into and die? Did you notice the shin rails? Like, there are railings, but not high enough for you to actually put your hand on. In fact, they are at the
High
perfect.
enough for you to trip over,
Yeah, they are
really.
at the perfect height for you to trip over the edge. Which makes me wonder if maybe they're just some kind of idiot test. It's like, if you're not smart enough to figure out how to walk down this corridor by yourself, you don't deserve to live.
That's how the Krell became so intelligent, Darwinism.
Yeah. So we find out that the Krell were your. You know, you're now sort of standard, although at the time I imagine it was kind of revolutionary. Species that had evolved to the point of being like hyper intelligent and having all this technology and trying to basically create something that would make their lives perfect. Like they wouldn't have to work anymore, they would just do what they wanted. And in another Star Trek theme, trying to do that ended up doing them in. And we don't know how yet.
Surprise, surprise.
But they've got, you know, they left behind some cool stuff, like this helmet you can put on your head that either kills you or makes you super smart, one of the two.
Yeah, it's 50-50, really.
Yeah, we don't, well, we, you know, we have a, it's really, I think, two-thirds, because we have records of three people trying it, and two of them died. But right now, that is, the third one hasn't happened yet. We know that that Morbius put it on, and he got super smart, but the captain of the Bellerophon put it on, and he died.
He got super dead.
Incidentally, did you notice that they use the word skipper a lot in this film?
Yeah, to refer to their captain, of
Yeah.
all things.
And well, like, it's weird because like skipper is like a naval term, but you don't hear it a lot in modern sci-fi.
No, you really don't. It just didn't catch on, I guess.
Like, you know, pretty much after Star Trek, it was always Captain.
Yeah.
You know, Sir, like in Battlestar Galactica or Babylon 5 or any of those others. It's not. It's very rarely Skipper. Maybe because...
Maybe you just think Skipper, Barbie's little sister, right?
Or just someone who skips a lot.
Or the douchey dude from Gilligan's Island.
You know too many things about Gilligan's Island, Grace. Too many.
I know a standard amount of things about Gilligan's Island, Oren.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Which leads me to another realization I had, which I'll bring up later.
All right, we'll get back to that. So in the meantime, we end. You know, they end their grand tour, and they're all very impressed, and it turns... And then we go back to the ship, and they've set up, like, this nice little, you know, laser force field fence to keep out, you know, the invisible monsters. And that doesn't work very well.
No.
And in the version that I have, which is the 2006 50th anniversary edition, they've clearly, you know, enhanced all the special effects. And by enhanced, I mean made them look more like Looney Tunes. Because, like, the monster steps through the fence and is invisible, it turns out. For some reason. But the fence, like, makes it briefly visible as an outline.
Because it's getting shocked.
And it looks like... It really looks like a Looney Tunes monster to me. Like, it looks kind of like that giant red monster in some of the Bugs Bunny cartoons.
Honestly, I thought that the giant monster was one of the high points of the movie, because it was interesting looking. It was really well animated also. And I thought it was just really cool to see that kind of melding of... film culture at the time with cartoon culture as it was at the time. And the guy who they got to come in and do the animation for that worked on so many of the classic Disney movies that guy knew what he was doing, and you can really see that in his work.
Cool.
Just in the monster's movement and the consistency of it, and it's really cool.
Yeah, and it's...
The animation nerd in me freak out.
Yeah, no doubt. I mean, the animation's not bad. It just looked a little bit... Like, I could tell that the animation had been added later.
Yeah.
Because it didn't Yeah, because it didn't quite match the level of the rest of the film. Not in that it wasn't as good, it just didn't... It didn't quite jive for me.
It was also kind of neat, though, that when they animated in the special effects, it just added to making the whole thing look cartoony.
Mm-hmm. No, it totally did. So anyway, the invisible monster sneaks...
When they were making the movie, they were specifically trying to not make it like a B-movie, but still, in hindsight, there's the level of kitschiness to it that's inescapable, and that adds to that level of kitschiness and makes it kind of fun.
There is. Once we get to the end of the recap, I'll give my overall review of it. So, you know, the invisible monster sneaks through the fence, and nobody is any the wiser. And I think it's at this point when the cook, who is kind of the clown of the movie, is off getting drunk with Robbie the robot.
Because he gets Robbie to replicate a bunch of booze in the hall.
Yeah. And, you know, there's like, it's this really hilarious scene when he is like, you know, walking through the rocks and the shrub, and he comes around a corner and there's like this giant mountain of whiskey bottles. And it's just like, that is a lot of booze. So, while he's getting drunk, the chief engineer gets moited.
Moited?
Moited. And it's all, you know, very sad, and the captain's very upset and angry. And, like, at one point yells at the crewman who fell asleep, but, like, I think was supposed to be asleep. Like, I don't think he was on guard duty. I think he was just, he had a bunk near the door and thought he heard something.
Yeah.
Or, like, was having a dream or something, and the captain got really mad at him for some reason.
How dare you not take extra responsibilities that I didn't ask you to take? How dare you?
So they go back to yell at Morbius some more, and I think this is where we get the official kickoff of the incredibly uncomfortable romance.
Yeah.
Because you got, you know, like, Alta hanging out with Lieutenant Jerry Farman, and he's Jerry all Falwell? Like, hey.
Jerry Falwell?
I think it's Farman. And so he's all, you know, being like, kissing is a thing we do sometimes to, you know, show affection or what have you. And, like, let's kiss. And it's a little bit like, why? And the look that she gives him is kind of fun. It's just, she's just being totally deadpan about the whole thing.
She's just not getting the appeal.
She's just like, why is this a thing? Like, I'm not really interested. I guess we can do this some more if you want. But, like, why? What's the point? Which is the only thing that really salvages that scene for him, because he is being a total creep-tastic guy. And then it ironically gets worse when the commander shows up and shoos him off and then yells at her like this is all her fault.
How dare you dress so provocatively around men who haven't seen women in forever?
Yeah, which I think might be the earliest recorded example I've ever seen of slut-shaming.
It's probably earlier, but
I'm sure there
are. It's pretty blatantly slut-shaming, yeah.
Yeah, it was just very, I guess, the implication of that scene is, like, what they were trying to go for was the idea that she doesn't understand, like, society or civilized manners.
Yeah.
So, like, he's instructing her on what's proper, but it's just like, ugh.
It comes off as him being really douchey at a girl who doesn't know better.
It really does.
Who doesn't care, really.
Yeah, but the upshot of all this is that she, you know, thinks he's kind of full of it.
Yeah.
Unfortunately,
which of course means that she totally digs him.
Yeah, she eventually will, you know, totally dig him. So they yell at Morbius some more, and Morbius is being very uncooperative about this whole thing. But you can't help but suspect Morbius. Like, he is dressed like a villain. He wears, like, all black. He has this super neat hair and this very well-trimmed beard.
And he kind of looks like a poor man's Christopher Lee.
Yeah, he's just like, you know, he looks like a villain.
Yeah.
And so when that doesn't work, they have monster battle, invisible monster battle.
Dun, dun, dun.
Because monster comes back, and they're all like, hey, what's going on with this monster? So they shoot it with a bunch of lasers, and that doesn't work. But for some reason, the monster seems pretty content to just hang out in the spot where they're shooting at it. And it only kills
he's
some of them.
He's not going anywhere. He's got all the time in the world.
Yeah, it only kills some of them because they run up to it, and then it eats them. Which is, and like, you know, a little bit like, maybe you guys should have just stayed back and you would have been fine.
Yeah.
So after this, we are told that, by the way, there's only stops because apparently Altia was having a terrible dream and she got all screamy and then she woke up her father, which is like, yeah. Dun, dun, dun! That you know, that is something going on.
Mm-hmm.
And at this point, we hear that that Mr. Jerry kind of rapist Farman is one of the people who got murdered. And honestly, it's hard for me to tell because they all look the same.
They all have the exact same hairdo. And
they're all the, you know, they're all white guys with the same haircut and the same facial features and like the same outfit. And I cannot tell them apart.
Yeah, that's the big challenge of the whole movie right there.
Like, I can kind of tell the commander apart from the rest, and I can tell the doctor apart because he's cool. I like the doctor.
We can tell the commander apart because he's Leslie Nielsen.
Yeah, but like the rest of the crew members, I was like looking at him and I have no idea who's who.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, we get told that he was one of the guys who got dead.
Yeah, he caught the dead.
And this is where we find out that Alta totally lerves the captain and thinks he's like the best.
Totally lerves him.
Which is where we get one of the more confusing scenes in the movie, I think.
Yeah.
Which is when the tiger that was her friend before suddenly leaps at her with the intent to kill. And
Captain instantly shoots it.
Yeah, the captain shoots it. So I guess we really only have his word that it was going to attack her. I mean, maybe it was just...
She's like, yeah, that tiger didn't recognize me.
And it's like, I guess...
Maybe because you've never been in the same damn shot as him. You've never actually met. You've just been spliced together as friends.
Now, that scene is a little bit confusing, but I'll get back to why exactly as soon as we explain what's really going on over here.
Mm-hmm.
So the captain and, or the commander, excuse me, and the doctor have decided that they need to put on the, you know, the smart helmet, the smart death helmet. Because otherwise they can't figure out what's going on here.
Yeah.
And so the doctor sneaks away and does it first because he doesn't want the captain to get dead.
Yeah.
And he, you know, he gets super smart, but also dead. But before he dies,
very smart in death.
But before he dies, he gives some foreshadowing about what's going on and talks about how the Krell forgot about the monster from the id.
Bum bum bum.
And basically, at this point, we figure out, or at least the captain figures out, that what's going on is that Morbius is hooked up to this giant power projector, and it's projecting his subconscious out to do what he secretly wants to have done. Which is, you know, kill all of the people from his old crew because they didn't like the planet as much as he did and they wanted to leave.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, destroy the communications equipment on the CD, or on the C-57D. And, you know, just so they can't contact Earth, and then start killing them so they can't, you know, leave and take his daughter away. And so it does all those things, and, you know, Morbius is suitably upset when he finds this out. And they have, like, this cool chase scene where they run down a tunnel, and, like,
They're, like, running through all the Krell, like, secret super enhanced doors and stuff.
And they describe the end of the Krell as basically being this, you know, the incredibly advanced race, which had gone to the peak of their technology, you know, technological evolution, and discovered this, like, you know, this technology that was going to be their crowning achievement, as it was called in the film. But because they were so smart and, like, so well civilized, they'd forgotten that they had their subconscious. And so when they plugged themselves into this mind projector, they wiped themselves out with these subconscious urges, which I actually think is kind of poetic.
Yeah.
I kind of like it a lot.
That's part of the beauty of the movie, I guess, right there.
And so at this point, this is what brought up what I was confused about with the tiger. I wasn't sure if the tiger was attacking her because it was picking up on her father being angry, or if it was meant that it was attacking her because she was no longer pure.
Maybe, either one.
Because she had been kissing, like, a guy.
Yeah.
And I'm honestly not sure what was going on with that tiger.
I don't know, maybe it's like because she was tainted by something not of that planet.
Maybe.
That's what I got from it, so.
Because, like, the tiger wasn't supposed to be a projection of Morpheus's mind. Morbius. Because, like, the tiger, they explained that the reason there were tigers and deer there were because the Krell had gone around and, you know, taken a bunch of genetic samples from other planets.
Which is kind of creepy.
It is a little bit. Just a little bit. You know, they didn't have any human colonists, as far as we know, but... So I don't know exactly what the premise of that scene was, but it was very strange.
Mm-hmm.
So they managed to get into, like, the, you know, the final room in the Krell ruins, and they have this really cool sequence where the monster is, like, melting through the door.
Yeah, that was actually pretty cool.
To, like, chase after them. And it's like, they're actually, that was actually like melting iron they were using. I have no idea how they spliced it into that shot, because I assume they didn't have a bunch of melting iron on set.
You don't know that.
I don't. But it was really cool regardless.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, they eventually convince Morbius that this is like his creation. And so he runs to try to fight it, I guess. And we hear a lot of yelling from off screen.
Not before we get a little moment of, Ultra.
Yeah.
Talking to her dad and having a very moment with her dad that's very, but daddy, I love him.
Well, yeah. Because, you know,
really.
He's like, why would you ever want to leave here? And she was like, Dad, I would really like to try sex. Okay.
And she wants to move out of her dad's house.
Yeah. There's that too.
She didn't even know what kissing was. Think of what else she hasn't gotten to learn about.
They actually imply that she does know what it is. They have a whole, like, I've studied biology, wink, wink. So, you know, that there's a little bit of subtext there. But I really like how when Morbius goes to fight the monster, we get a bunch of off-screen, like, shouting. And I have no idea what's supposed to actually be happening. And then he stumbles back, and then he dies for some reason. I guess he was tired. You know,
he just got wiped out, really.
But the monster's gone, so success.
Yeah. With him dies his id and ego.
But his super ego, what about that?
Sequel.
But then, as he's dying, he says, hey, Captain, flip a switch. And the captain is like, okay, and he doesn't really flip a switch, he really pushes in a plunger, but, you know, sure, it could be a switch, why not? And that sets the planet to self-destruct. And I was a little bit
like you, because I guess if he couldn't have this planet, no one could?
Nobody can!
No one gets to learn about the Krell, no one understands them like me! Oh my god, that totally... That makes sense. It's like he's their fanboy, and no one else can have the fandom but him, because he's the one true fan.
Oh, we were talking.
Oh my god!
Oh man, this
That's how this influenced Star Trek.
our off-topic rant earlier somehow ended up being connected with our topic. Ooh.
Oh my God, what just happened?
And in the the final phase of the movie, you end up with all of them back on board the C-57-D, watching the planet explode, and the commander is given Alta this speech about how in 2 million years humans will be as cool as the Krell, and that's supposed to make her feel better, I guess, that her dad is dead. And
But Robbie's on the ship now.
yeah, but Robbie is back, and really, what else could you possibly ask for?
That's true.
I love Robbie.
Yeah.
All right, so
Honestly, I reached a point when I was watching the movie where I realized this movie takes on a whole nother aspect if you think of Robbie as the main character.
oh yeah. I mean,
He's just like the guy who's been created, and he's more intelligent than he needs to be, and just has to put up with all this crap from Morbius and his bratty daughter who's having him make her dresses and stuff.
and then like these new guys show up and he's like, hey, maybe I can talk to them, and they're all even dumber, and like one of them is like, make me booze, and he's like, okay.
But Robbie learns to party, and then he gets to go to space.
And he replaces the dead quasi-rapist, because apparently his actual job on the ship was astrogation.
Yeah.
So now we have a robot, which is far so as far as I'm concerned, this trip is like a net bonus.
Yeah.
Success. We have awesome robot.
We got a robot and we got a babe.
And
We just lost a few douches along the way.
yeah, we lost some red shirts and a guy nobody liked. So,
And we got a whole crap ton of booze haul.
and let me tell you, these guys were red shirts before there were red shirts, okay?
Yeah,
Even
really.
though they're all part of the same like department. You also they so they had a view screen, but for some reason they called it a view plate. I really don't know why they called it like, because they use the word screen at other points in the movie.
Yeah, that's a little odd.
But for some reason, viewplate, that was how they looked outside.
All right, so while we're still vaguely on the topic, close to the topic of Robbie, I want to bring this up. Apparently, the whole plot of this movie is very loosely based off of William Shakespeare's The Tempest.
Yeah,
And
it
it's
is.
got a lot of the same themes. This guy who runs away from society to pursue his own, genius and what have you, and raises his daughter in isolation. Which was all, pretty obvious to me, except with Robbie. And I was asking myself pretty early on in the movie, knowing this, does that make Robbie the Caliban of the story, who's like this slave that's kept by the sorcerer in the Tempest and rebels and, tries to screw everyone over because he's just full of so much rage? Or is he the Ariel who is just there working for Prospero of his own volition and is just hoping to, get something good out of it one of these days?
I think that
That's why I was kind of left wondering a whole movie. And that's why I probably also the whole movie, I was like, Robbie's gonna snap. Robbie's just gonna go nuts and kill everything.
I wouldn't have had too much of a problem with that, because Robbie was my
It would
favorite
have
character.
gotten a movie poster then.
Yeah. So Robbie, I think, is kind of a combination of Caliban and Ariel. Like, he's more Ariel, but at the same time, he only kind of fills that role because, like, Ariel is basically just Prospero's go-to guy.
Pretty much, yeah.
Like, anything that Prospero needs done, Ariel is gonna do it. And whereas Robbie only does a couple of things, he, like, fetches them from the ship once, and but that's about it.
And he heats up the coffee and makes their food and disintegrates stuff.
Yeah. But at more, he's being asked to do like really menial stuff, which is kind of what Caliban was all about.
Yeah.
He's not really being tasked with anything important, even though he could clearly do very important things. So
Well,
he's.
it's kind of implied in The Tempest that there was a point where Prospero trusted enough to, give him important tasks, but then he made the moves on his daughter Miranda and tried to, have his way with her, and then he was like, nope, you're my slave now.
Which I think we can all trust Robbie not ever to do, because Robbie's a cool guy.
He's not Robbie the Rapist.
No, he's not, thankfully.
That would make his little hand so much creepier.
All right. So, all right. Thanks, Grace. We've gone there now. We can't ungo there.
Nope.
So in more things that you got going on with the Tempest, so obviously Morbius is kind of like Prospero.
Mm-hmm.
Not exactly like Prospero, because Prospero, the reason
in a similar vein, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, they're both, like, you know, sort of men of great intellect who have been who are marooned on these remote places.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a big difference is that Prospero wants to leave his island.
Eventually,
like,
yeah.
That's eventually revealed to be his motivation. Mm-hmm. It doesn't, it's not there immediately in the play, but eventually it is a thing. Whereas Morbius' entire character is based around him not wanting to leave the island.
Yeah.
Or the planet, in this case. And, of course, the big reason why I don't much care for The Tempest as a play is because there's no tension for me anywhere, because Prospero is basically God. Like, Prospero is so powerful, he can do whatever he wants, whenever he mm-hmm. wants. And, you know, there's, like, that really sort of comical attempt by Caliban and two of the other guys to try to take him out, and we know that's not going to work.
Yeah.
Like, it's obvious that it's not going to work. And so the only other real drama of the story is Miranda and whoever her prince was named.
Yeah. What's-his-face.
Yeah, Prince What's-his-face. and that love story wasn't all that interesting to me, because they basically met and then were in love.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas Forbidden Planet... I actually really liked Forbidden Planet.
Yeah.
I think it's a legitimately good movie once you get past the extreme sexism and the somewhat implied racism.
Yeah.
Of everyone's white.
Yeah.
Once you get past that, it's a pretty good story. It's like, mm-hmm. you know, it has this mystery villain. Morbius is sort of the villain, but also kind of not the villain. It kind of gets into the issues of our subconscious.
Yeah, it's got a level of moral ambivalence to it when it comes to Morbius.
Yeah, it's like a lot of episodes of Star Trek where there is danger, like there is a peril of some kind,
uh-huh.
but it's not directly because of the acts of any one individual.
Yeah.
Like, you know, the solution is not something where you can just go punch that person in the face until he stops, right?
Yeah.
Although I guess technically they could have probably fixed the situation by killing Morbius. That wasn't something they wanted to do.
Yeah.
Because he wasn't, like, actively trying to hurt them.
Mm-hmm.
Even though he is creepy as all get out.
Yeah.
Or sinister, really. And, of course, you have Cook, or Cookie, as he's called,
mm-hmm.
who basically exists just to be the clown character.
To get drunk and be stupid and say, man, they got no pool halls here.
Yeah, like, you know, he doesn't really... He's really...
What did you think you signed on for, Cookie?
Mm-hmm.
What did you think... Where did you think you were going? Did you think you were going to, like, the Mars in Total Recall?
Look, he thought they were going to be, you know, green alien women here, all right? He'd watched Star Trek.
Exactly misinformed.
He'd watched Star Trek before he signed up for this mission.
He fell for all the propaganda videos.
Yeah. It was also really... Did you notice how in the beginning, like... They had a bunch of the crewmen just sort of sitting on a couch in the bridge. Just
yeah.
Like this couch in the back. And I'm like, that's kind of neat. I like that couch. I don't know why it's on the bridge exactly.
Yeah. So they can sit down comfortably and take a nap if they need to. All
right. So you want to talk about the look of the film?
Yeah.
All right. So I definitely noticed that the Enterprise Bridge is inspired a lot by by some of the looks of the... Bridge of the, excuse me, the C-57D. I've never heard
of
that.
Yeah, it's definitely got that retro-futurist look that Star Trek also had.
Yeah, I mean, at the time it's not retro, but yeah, now it's, you know, a retro-futurist look.
Yeah.
Although, the thing that really jumped out at me is, you know Dr. Morbius's, like, secret study that he has? It mm-hmm. really looks like the inside of Kirk's quarters from Star Trek 2.
Yeah.
Like, a lot.
Like a little more than coincidentally.
Yeah, like I'm pretty sure that the people who made Star Trek 2 were like, hey, that looked really neat. Let's reference that in our set.
Wouldn't be surprising.
And it's also kind of funny that, you know, you have like the ship landing and it's this big special effects sequence.
Mm-hmm.
And I think I mentioned before that was probably what Roddenberry was avoiding when he invented the transport. He was like, no, guys, we don't have to do this every week.
Yeah.
It's also interesting, it really puts...
Like Ex Machina, really.
Yeah. It really puts into perspective how pervasive the flying saucer design was for spaceships at that point.
Cause, it really does, doesn't it?
Well, because, like, spaceships at this point basically came in two flavors. You had the rocket, which is all the rocket spaceships basically look like V2s, you know, from World War II.
Yeah.
And then you have the flying saucer, and I don't know where the flying saucer originated exactly. But it's kind of interesting because the Enterprise is almost a combination of those two things.
Yeah, it is. It really is. It's got the flying the saucer section, and it's got the multiple rockety-looking parts on it.
Yeah, so it's just something...
I hadn't really thought about that before, so...
Yeah, just something I thought was interesting.
Yeah.
Because I know that a lot of, like, the, you know, the 40s-era sci-fi stuff, they really look like V2 rockets.
Yeah.
It's, you know, it's you just look at them and you can really tell where the design came from.
Absolutely.
And there's also the sound effects are very similar to some of the sort of the passive sound effects, like the beeps and the bloops in the background. They sound
the beeps and the sweeps.
Yeah, the creeps, the beeps and the sweeps. And they all sound very much like what's going on in Star Trek.
I guess those were just kind of the stock science fiction sound effects they had.
Now,
and that's what they were going to work with.
So I was a little unclear on this, because so you know they have that sequence where they all jump into like what looks like a transporter, but is not really.
Yeah.
For when they're like shifting out of light speed. Were they in that for a long time, or was that just for them to like shift out of high speed so they wouldn't all get like splatted against the back wall?
I'm gonna go with the second one.
They definitely talked about how it took them, like, a year to get there. So I assume they weren't all in suspended animation for that entire time, or it probably wouldn't have bothered them so much.
Yeah, we can assume that.
One thing that was very unusual was that in the intro, they make a big deal about how men and women, they say that, had, like, reached the moon and conquered space. And then, like, the movie starts and the entire crew is guys.
Yeah, they're like, oh yeah, women can totally do that. We just don't care about them.
We just didn't hire any.
We were just afraid that if we brought them on, it would look like tokenism. That's why it's only white guys also.
Yep.
So everyone feels comfortable.
We don't have to, you know, no one will accuse us of poorly handling minority or female characters if we just don't have any. Brilliant!
Yeah.
All right.
Delightful.
And we already kind of talked about, like, because there's a bunch of scenes that just are very uncomfortable, I think, for a modern audience.
Yeah.
Like, it's just sort of, I don't understand why Alta falls for the captain. It's sort of like...
I guess because he's one guy who doesn't throw himself at her.
Yeah, it's just sort of like, because, like, the commander, or not the commander, excuse me, the farman, like, the first guy, was all like, I want to make out with you, and she was like, I'm not really interested.
Yeah.
And then, like, the captain comes along and yells at her and tells her to put on better clothes, and suddenly she's all like, now I'm smitten.
Maybe it's sort of that 60s mentality that girls are all drawn to father figures or something.
Maybe. If you just project an air of authority, the women will flock to your door.
Exactly, yeah.
Yeah.
Creepy.
And it's also, you know, it's just kind of weird that they have this, like, side plot where she goes and, like, gets a new dress made and...
Just to impress him.
Yeah. And it's, you know, and I'm not sure what I thought about the swimming scene.
Yeah, that was just weird. I think that was more of, like, a kind of stranger in a strange land kind of, oh, she's not inhibited kind of thing. Although you could totally see she was wearing a swimsuit and she's supposed to be swimming naked.
Yeah, it was a flesh-colored swimming suit. Basically, it was basically the same thing as being naked. And then, of course, what we really needed that scene for was so the doctor could sneak away and put on the plastic, like, helmety thing.
Yeah.
You know, which is, interestingly enough, it is kind of a mirror to Spock's brain a little bit. In Spock's brain, they have an alien thing that you put on your head and it makes you super smart.
Delightful.
And I don't know if it was used anywhere else or not. But it was that was just the first thing I thought of when I saw that thing. I was like, wait, this is Spock's brain. I've seen this before. So, if you don't mind, I would like to talk about some of the big themes that were in this movie that we would see repeated over and over again in TOS.
Yes.
And
there are many of them.
There are definitely a few. My first that I noticed, which is the race with super powerful alien technology that we are not allowed to have.
Yeah.
Like, I can't count how many times in Star Trek they would run into aliens who were like, hey, we got these super powerful, you know, warp cores the size of walnuts, which is a direct quote, I think, from, I don't remember the name of the TOS episode that it's in, but basically, we have all this super technology, and wouldn't you like to see it, but you can't. And I think this is the first time that, or, no, I'm sorry, this isn't actually in Star Trek, but this is, unlike in Star Trek, these aliens are actually dead. Usually in Star Trek, they're alive, and they tell you to leave at the end of the episode.
Maybe the whole thing is just a very sixth, mid-century response to the sudden influx of technology that was openly available and being afraid of it.
Oh, yeah. No, that's definitely a thing. I mean, we're still sort of seeing that today. I listened to an NPR interview with this guy who was, I hated him. Like, he was being such a jerk. He was like a tech guy. Like, he works in the tech industry. And he was just talking about how we should automate, like, everybody's job. And I was like, you are the reason where people are afraid of technology. It's not the actual technology. It's people like you who think that our goal should be to make the most efficient society we can. And, you know, never mind if it impoverishes everyone in it.
Just because we can do something definitely doesn't mean we should.
Yeah, it's just, you know, like it or not, the system we have set up right now assumes that you have a job. That's how, you know, that's how you earn the currency which you use to buy necessities. And so if we take away everyone's job, so a machine that's more efficient can do it, we take away their ability to earn currency, but things are still going to cost money, right?
Yeah.
So, I don't know, the way he was so short-sighted was just, and this all came about because he was annoyed that he had to, you know, commute longer because the transportation workers in San Francisco, like, went on strike.
Man, what a little bitch.
And he was just really upset. Like, this, like, he was so angry that this inconvenienced him that he was just like, we should just automate all their jobs.
That's very short-sighted.
I was happy because
and kind of classist, too. I mean, what about his job? Did he think about that?
Exactly. And it was funny because, like, the NPR reporter was like, you know, actually took him down to the train station and was like, I would like you to talk to some of these people.
Yeah.
And then tell me if you want their jobs to be automated. I enjoyed what she was doing, but he was a jerk.
Yeah.
So that just kind of illustrates that there is a definite fear of technology. And we see the same thing with the message of don't let your technology go too far.
Mm-hmm.
It'll get you in the end.
Dun, dun, dun.
Which is something that we saw repeated over and over and over again in Star Trek with, like in TOS especially, with Miri, which is, you know, one of the earlier episodes where there are these people who were working on life extension tech and it killed them all. And then a couple more times, like over the course of the series. And it's sort of the same idea of especially if it's, and I think this had something to do with our dislike of communism at the time, because it's like, if the technology takes away your need to work, especially, that's bad.
Then it'll be kind of an equalizer also, won't it?
Yeah, that sounds awful communist to me.
Comet.
Especially, you know, and you see that in what's it called? This Side of Paradise.
Yeah.
Which is the Spores episode.
Spores.
And it feels like it all really started back here with Forbidden Planet. And of course, I feel like the Doctor and McCoy are almost interchangeable because they're both like, I really like both of those characters.
Yeah.
And whoever, the guy playing the Doctor is not, is no, you know, DeForest Kelly, but he does a pretty good job regardless.
On the topic of This Side of Paradise, another theme that we see really explored through just about all of the Star Trek series is this idea of, yes, this is paradise, but at what cost? That kind of thing, you know?
Yeah, definitely. Let's see, what other, like, I remember that from a couple of different episodes, like in Justice in early TNG, which is the one where Wesley gets sentenced to death for stepping on some grass.
Yeah. For killing some flowers.
And I mean, that theme runs like throughout, you know, sci-fi and fantasy, like novels and games. I mean, heck, have you played Bioshock Infinite?
No, not yet, but
well, you know, this isn't really a spoiler. This is just the plot. You immediately, you know, you go to this city that seems like a utopia, and like I could just immediately tell there was some dark secret because this place is way too nice.
Well, that was also the plot of, you know, BioShock. It was great for the people who lived there until everything went to hell.
Right. Although in BioShock, you show up after the city's already been wrecked, right?
Yeah. So you kind of know what's in store.
Whereas in Infinite, when you show up in Columbia, it's like everything is perfect, and it's like, all right, what's going on here? What's your angle, man? You know, to the point where I would be, at this point, I would be really suspicious if I, like, you know, if I started, like, a story and it was a utopian society where everything was perfect, but nothing was actually wrong with it.
Everything was perfect until evil came!
Like, I would just keep waiting for what's the reveal? Like, what's wrong with this perfect society that we have going on here?
Yeah.
Which is sort of funny, because that theme runs through Star Trek over and over again, but Earth is supposed to be, like, a paradise.
Yeah, but the only person who really questions that is Captain Sisko, isn't it?
Yeah, like, well, Sisko has...
how we've become morally complacent from being in a kind of paradise.
Yeah, well, yeah, Sisko has that whole speech in, The Maquis.
He's a saint in paradise.
Yeah. Where where he's like basically saying that maybe, you know, we can't assume everyone will act the same way we do.
Can I get an award for worst Benjamin Sisko impression?
Man, made me think about Avery Brooks. He's scary. He could be behind me. I don't know.
Avery Brooks isn't watching you at all times.
He might be, though. He only needs to watch me some of the time.
You just have to watch you a few hours a day to scare you into complacency.
Yeah, just a little bit. All right, so that's Forbidden Planet for you.
Yeah.
Is there stuff?
It's
other
like
stuff?
An episode of Star Trek, only really chatty.
Yeah, they talk a lot, which I give it a lot of credit for that. Like, they talk a whole bunch, but it's not boring.
It's a very cerebral science fiction movie. Yeah. Well, not very cerebral, but it is cerebral.
It's relatively cerebral, and there's not a lot of action, and I think that probably has to do with the constraints of the budget.
That and the fact that they were really trying to emphasize that this was a science fiction movie that was like a motion picture experience and not just another shoot 'em up B movie.
Right, which is funny that, like, the paradigm really seems to have shifted, right? Whereas,
yeah,
you know, before, if you wanted a movie that was going to be taken seriously, you had to, like, you know, lay off all the action sequences and all of the, like, the laser fights and space combat.
Yeah.
So that was for the pulp movies, right? Like, that was that was for the lesser genre works. But nowadays, it's, like, the other way around. Like, you know, now, if you want everyone to like your movie, you have to put in as many laser fights as possible. And if you have more than, like, a few minutes of dialogue, everyone accuses you of being, like, you know, too elitist and intellectual.
Uh-huh.
And, I mean, obviously, you could use a bit of a balance, right?
Yeah.
But I think that, you know, I'm not sure how well Forbidden Planet would do if it opened today. Probably not great. But I think just watching it today, like, as a, you know, 26-year-old, I really enjoy it. Like, parts about it that I don't like are entirely based on racial and gender and, you know, insensitivities and prejudice. And, you know, have nothing to do with the fact that there's not a lot of action. Also, Robbie the Robot. He's like...
Robbie the Robot!
Is, like, the best character, and I would like him to come back. Can we have a sequel?
Why didn't he get a sequel?
Well, apparently, they've been talking about...
He's been going on, like, Short Circuit-style adventures.
They've been talking about making a remake for a while now.
Around too, but apparently that's been in talks for a while now. So
yeah, and I'm kind of hoping it would be like a sequel rather than a straight up remake.
Yeah.
Because it's weird, because, you know, Forbidden Planet is already a reimagining of The Tempest, mm-hmm. So it would be like a remake of a remake.
Yo, dog! We heard you liked remakes.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm.
But I would totally watch a sequel, not just because of Robbie the Robot.
It would be interesting to see what they would do.
And, you know, this is one of the first works that really showed the idea of, like, a united, like, space nation. Like, it wasn't just Earth, right? They're called the United Planets. Now, you know, we don't know if there are any non-humans in that alliance. The theory seems to be no, because there aren't any on this crew, but...
Yeah.
Sort of you could definitely see it as a precursor to the Federation.
Totally. Matching jumpsuits and all.
Yep. although theirs aren't brightly colored, which I think is their loss. Yeah, I definitely feel more for the brightly colored uniforms now, because it's like, after looking at a show where all their uniforms look exactly the same, it's like, I have a hard time telling them apart.
Yeah.
At least in Enterprise, they had the collar colors, even though they were all wearing, like, those blue coveralls.
Made them all look like grease monkeys.
Yeah, just a little bit. At least they had pockets, though. I'll give them that.
That's useful.
All right, well, is there anything else we need to say about Forbidden Planet?
Not really.
All right. Well, thank you, everyone, for joining us. Apologies that this couldn't be live and that David couldn't be here, but he will hopefully be here next week. And if all goes well, we will be interviewing, I believe I'm saying her name right, Jera Haj, who is a feminist blogger who I met at Star Trek Las Vegas.